from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, growing up around Alaska's pimps, prostitutes, gamblers, and con men, we talk with Kim Rich. Her father is one of Anchorage's most notorious underworld figures during that city's oil boom years. Also today, we talk with journalist Eric Larson about how the direct mail business has invaded our lives. Larson set up his own phony direct mail business to get at trade secrets. And city dweller Maureen Corrigan tells us about her recent suburban nightmare. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Senate Armed Services Committee held a second day of hearings today on the ban against homosexuals in the military. Among those who endorsed the change was Lawrence Korb, a former Pentagon manpower chief during the Reagan administration. Korb said he didn't believe that admitting homosexuals to the military would undermine unit cohesion any more than racial integration or improved opportunities for women. Korb said that, in fact, he believes the removal of the ban on homosexuals would have less short-term effect on unit cohesion. David Marlowe, a top military psychiatrist, disagreed with Korb, saying it's likely to be far more difficult to integrate homosexuals in military units. Today, the U.S. Trade Representative's Office published its annual report on foreign trade barriers, accusing 44 countries of practices that hurt American exports. NPR's John Idstey reports.
Today's report is a thick summary of the offending practices of other countries. The largest number of pages in the document deal with trade barriers in Japan, followed by the European Community. But the report contains no announcements of new retaliatory measures. In fact, because of limited resources, U.S. trade negotiators are unable to enter talks on all the unfair practices listed. U.S. Trade Representative Mickey Cantor said in a statement that the report would help establish trade priorities. In the past couple of months, the administration has focused on what it says are unfair European Community trade practices in aerospace and government procurement. But recently, the administration's rhetoric has become more strident toward Japan. Yesterday, Cantor said the Japanese must become more involved if the GATT world trade talks are to be completed. I'm John Idstein, Washington.
Another suspect has been indicted in the February 26th bombing of the World Trade Center, but the man has apparently not been arrested yet. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
A grand jury in New York today handed up a superseding indictment of the suspects in the Trade Center bombing. The indictment includes a new name, 25-year-old Ramzi Ahmed Youssef. The address listed for him is the same Jersey City, New Jersey apartment where the first suspect, Mohammed Salama, lived. The U.S. Attorney's Office said Youssef has not been arrested yet, and it's believed that he is hiding from investigators. Today's indictment accuses Youssef and three of the other suspects of maliciously damaging and destroying the World Trade Center by means of an explosive device, leading to the deaths of six people. The charge carries with it a maximum penalty of life in prison and a $250,000 fine. Youssef is the fifth man to be charged with the bombing. A sixth person is said to be a suspect and is being held on unrelated charges. In New York, this is Jim Zeroli reporting.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 22 points to close at 3,435. Advances led declines by a slight margin in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The United Nations Security Council has voted to authorize the use of military action to enforce the so-called no-fly zone over Bosnia. The order prohibiting military flights over Bosnia is aimed mainly at the Bosnian Serbs, who have the only effective air power in the former Yugoslav Republic. The vote on the long-delayed resolution was 14 in favor and none against, with China abstaining. U.S. policy toward Vietnam is under urgent and intensive review, according to the Clinton administration's top Asia expert. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
At his Senate confirmation hearings today, Assistant Secretary of State-designate Winston Lord said the administration is weighing several factors as it considers normalizing relations with Vietnam. A full accounting of Americans missing in the Vietnam War is a top priority, he said, adding that there's been substantial progress on this issue. The administration is also aware that America's trade competitors are moving into Vietnam, possibly taking opportunities away from American businesses, which are held back by a U.S. embargo. Lord argued that the United States does not have to choose between MIAs on the one hand and trade on the other.
You can make the case that you can go forward carefully, but that you can pursue all your objectives simultaneously.
Lord said more U.S. engagement with Vietnam rather than less can help resolve remaining POW-MIA cases more quickly. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun has temporarily blocked a North Dakota abortion law that was to have taken effect today. The law would require women to obtain state-approved information on abortion alternatives and then wait 24 hours before having an abortion. Blackmun's order halts enforcement of the law but refers the issue to the full Supreme Court. The order came in response to an emergency request by the operators of North Dakota's only abortion clinic. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. To most of us in the lower 48, growing up in Anchorage, Alaska is a pretty exotic idea in and of itself. My guest Kim Rich grew up in Anchorage, and her father was one of that city's most notorious underworld figures. For a long time, her father's FBI rap sheet was the only recorded family history she had. Her father was murdered in 1973. Kim was 15. Years after the investigation of his murder, she conducted her own investigation into her family history. She's written a memoir about growing up in Alaska's underworld called Johnny's Girl. Now she's a journalist and divides her time between Alaska and New York, where she's in the graduate creative writing program at Columbia University. She told me how her father made a living when she was growing up.
When my parents moved, well, before they moved to Alaska, my father, from the research I was able to dig up, was in California, moving between San Francisco, Los Angeles, and San Diego. And according to his rap sheet, he was picked up in just about every city as a burglary suspect, which, as I write in the book, back in those days, that was something they could, you know, pick someone up, charge him with that just to hold him for a few days. So it's not clear to me exactly what he was doing in those cities. My guess is he was probably gambling, running around in the gambling scenes. He might have been fencing stolen property. When he came to Alaska in 58, initially he sold cars for a while. He always had some legitimate enterprise on the side going, but mostly he gambled. He started running after our gambling houses. Then he took over a hotel called the Safari in the early 60s, ran it for a bail bondsman who owned it. And from what I understand, that was where the streetwalkers would go. It was in the heart of Anchorage's downtown sort of red light district. Then he continued to basically run after ours gambling houses all the way up until the time of his death in the early 70s. And before his death, he was then running massage parlors, which were basic fronts for houses of prostitution.
He had one club that he called Le Pussycat, and his,
right.
Ads,
oh, right.
His ads had the Tom Jones song,
right.
What's New Pussycat, in it.
Isn't that great?
Yeah. Would you describe that club?
Yeah, that was one of his legitimate enterprises. I think if my father could do things in the way he probably really wanted to do them, he would have been a music promoter. And he tried to do that for a while, and the nightclub was part of that aspiration. He loved popular music, and that was a club he took over when I was about 9. It was called the North Starlight Lounge. He named it the Le Pussycat. I don't know where he got the name, but it was a nice club as far as nightclubs in Anchorage go. It was a large, boxy building, but on the inside it had a stage and a big bar and a nice mural on one wall. And they used to have these groups that back then, these sort of small quasi-Las Vegas-style bands that would, you know, you had guys playing the instrument and then two or three women who would front for the band and would dance, in these scantily clad costumes and would eventually take off all their clothes by the end of the set. And I remember I would go there when I was in fifth grade at the time. I would sometimes get to go there at night. And I loved it. It was a great place to be as a kid. It seemed all very exciting and glamorous to me. But I remember they would do songs like, you know, Ike and Tina Turner hits. And the women would come out. They would do, Paul Revere and the Raiders songs. And the women would wear Indian headdresses and fringed bikini bottoms and that sort of thing. Or they would carry muskets sort of for some Minutemen, kind of the English invasion thing.
So what did you make of this as a young girl? You know, staying up late nights, being in your father's club, seeing gambling, seeing prostitutes, seeing showgirls.
Well, I had an, depending on what the enterprise was and at what point in my life I was being exposed to it, at different times it was, you know, going to the nightclub was very exciting. I could stay up late and there was colored lights and live music and it was very engaging. There were other times later in, when I was 13 and my father was running an after-hours gambling house in my home that it wasn't so great because what it meant for me was that every morning at around 5 a.m., the downstairs of my house became a bar. And there was a lot of cigarette smoke and a lot of noise, and it would wake me up. And things like I have natural curly hair, and I was wearing these giant hair rollers at the time to take the kinks out of my hair. And being 13, I was very vain, and I didn't dare go downstairs with rollers in my hair. So I'd get up in the morning, and I'd have to use the bathroom, and I'd have to run around my room trying to get the curlers out of my hair just to go downstairs to go to the bathroom. And that often meant standing in line with people just to get into my own bathroom. I didn't like it then.
Your mother was a bar girl and a prostitute during parts of her life. How old were you when you found that out?
The book began as a newspaper series for the Anchorage Daily News, and so when I began the research for them, for the series, I think that's when I first learned what exactly it was she'd been doing in the early 60s in Anchorage. You know, the book is really sort of broken down into thirds, and the first third is my life with my parents from birth until age six. And it was during those years she was a B-girl and an occasional prostitute. From what I understand, this wasn't the thing she did most often, but did perhaps occasionally. And as a child, I had no idea what it was she did. I just know that she went to work at night, and every night at around 8 or 9 o'clock, she would get dressed up in cocktail dresses and high heels and would go out, and we had live-in sitters who would stay with me. So I didn't really, again, have a sense of what it was she did then. When I learned later, it didn't strike me as anything so surprising or awful. In fact, there had always been this sort of secrecy surrounding my mother's life and even her death. And I, as much as I could understand that as a small child, I knew that she wasn't well, because later when she had her first collapse, her mental illness collapse, I knew something was wrong with her, but I didn't know what. I remember when I got her, when I was speaking with a records person at this clinic where she had stayed, and they told me my mother had been schizophrenic and that she had worked as a prostitute. The two thoughts that went through my mind is, that's it? That's what everyone has been hiding all these years? They just didn't seem that awful to me.
But what exactly would you have to do as a B-girl or a bar girl?
Mostly they were high-priced cocktail waitresses. They would sit at a bar and encourage men to buy drinks and would get a commission for the drinks they sold. There's still some B-girl activity that goes on probably in every state. It's a thing that liquor commissions are still trying to chase down and eradicate. They also, from what I understand, you know, they would dance with the men. They would flirt with them. I wrote about in the book there were rooms in the back. They would sometimes take them to do, you know, heaven knows what, probably all kinds of things. Mostly they would just sit at the bar and get them to buy drinks. There's a picture in the book that a former B-girl friend of my mother's had and gave me. It's very striking to me because there's about, if I remember correctly, there's about a half dozen women sitting at the bar there, and they all look like your mother. They're all wearing, you know, high neckline sweaters and pearls. You know, they don't look like harlots, and they certainly don't look like streetwalkers.
It's funny you should say they all look like your mother. I mean, it was your mother.
Right, I know. These were, so they were sort of a cross between a cocktail waitress and a working girl. And it's not clear to me how many of them actually worked as prostitutes and how many just sold the drinks.
Your mother was institutionalized when you were young. When she got out of the hospital, she left your father. She bought two one-way tickets to Chicago and moved you to Ironwood, Michigan, her hometown. And you spent a couple of years there. Your mother was institutionalized again, so she wasn't home very much. And then, surprisingly, your father applied for custody. How much of a surprise was it for you when your father wanted to take you back with him to Alaska?
It was a relief at the time. Perhaps the hardest chapter in the book to write was the chapter on my years in Ironwood. In part because I have a lot of conflicted feelings about that, and it was a very painful period. In part because the people who I was living with at the time, my mother's family, are still living, and I, I wanted to bring some context to what I was going to say about them and about my years there. And in short, it's pretty simple to understand. I went from being with both my parents and living in a rather stable, if you will, home environment and loving environment to, at the age of six, being thrust into the world of strangers and relatives, and my mother having had her breakdown and my father living thousands of miles away. I was not happy about this as a six-year-old, seven-year-old, or eight-year-old, and perhaps no small child would be. I think that, you know, my mother's family, as I write about in the book, they did probably the best they could. When my father, but I was very unhappy there, and when I finally learned that he had gotten custody of me, and it was just announced to me one day, I mean, I had no inkling that this was coming. I was thrilled to be leaving Ironwood. I didn't like it there. I wanted to be with him. And I couldn't, you know, I wanted to be with my mother, but I certainly couldn't be with her because she wasn't well. So I was very happy about that prospect.
So your father came and got you, took you back to Alaska with him. He was still involved in all these illegal activities. And he would leave you alone at night. You know, when the Tonight Show came on, he'd go to his club or whatever, and you'd be alone. Was that really frightening?
It was lonely. And it could be frightening. You know, small children have very active imaginations. And, you know, I being no different, you know, for me, the monsters under my bed seemed more real, perhaps, than they did for other children who had parents down the hall. But I got used to it. I never liked it. But I did get used to it. To this day, I tend to fall asleep with a television on. It's a very easy thing for me to do because I did that for so many years with him. That was my company. I had a dog. I don't feel comfortable unless I have a dog in the house at night. And we always had a pet. And so the dog would become my companion and guardian. I never liked it, and I never quite got used to it.
Kim Rich is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Kim Rich is my guest. She's a writer who has a new memoir called Johnny's Girl, a daughter's memoir of growing up in Alaska's underworld. Your father was, in a way, a professional liar. I mean, you mm-hmm. know, he ran a lot of con games. He did a lot of illegal things. Was he straight with you?
Sometimes. There's a contradiction in the way my father... on the one hand, my father was... he didn't try to hide who he was to anyone. That's the thing that became abundantly clear to me in doing the book, and the thing that I'm most proud of him now, and even then had a sense. I mean, he was not a hypocrite, and he would often rail about hypocrites. He didn't, like, when I was smaller, he didn't come out and explain, this is what father does for a living. I'm a professional gambler, and this is why I'm leaving the house at midnight. He never quite explained it to me. But certainly when I got older, he didn't try to hide it either.
Once you found out what it was your father did for a living, you begged him to stop. You begged him to stop gambling.
Right.
What was his reaction?
Well, I don't know. There was a period of time there when I was 14. A number of events were coming together. One was I was tired of living in the house with the gambling. Two, my father had a very violent temper. And up until my teens, he never really expressed it except in, you know, he'd have these fits. He'd throw things. He'd break things. He'd yell. He'd stomp around. When I became 14 or when I think I was 13, 14, he started hitting me. And it was a combination of that and the gambling in the house that I finally, I believe I got the idea from a junior high school counselor. I went to state authorities and asked to be taken out of the home. 'Cause I don't remember an episode, for example, of standing around saying, I want this out of the house, and him saying no, but there must have been many of those because it didn't happen until I left the house and went to the state.
It must have been very difficult to initiate hearings against your own father.
Absolutely. It was very difficult. And there was a problem, too, because essentially a lot of what he was doing was illegal. And right away, I think we went to one hearing, and we couldn't proceed until I had an attorney because they could not promise me that anything I would say would not be used against him. And that was very important to me. I did not want to be turning, I guess even then at the time, I didn't want to be turning against him in the same way that the police and prosecutors had been, you know, were always after him. There were very specific things I wanted, and one of them, of course, was not that he be arrested and not that he be, you know, charged with any crimes as a result of his activities.
Did your father try to talk you out of testifying against him and try to talk you out of leaving him?
He tried to talk me out of leaving him. I don't know. Testifying against him didn't seem to be the issue so much as he just wanted me to come back home. You know, my father was, for the most part, a loner. And he was, as I write in the book, he was born an outsider and remained one his entire life. And I think clearly the only relationship that endured for him and that meant the most was his relationship with me. And I think I've talked to people who told me it was very devastating for him when I up and left the house. And so he very much wanted me to come back home. In fact, as a friend told me later, he ran into my father and he said, "John, where's Kim?" And he said, she left me. And so he very much wanted me back home to the point of agreeing to go to family counseling. This was not the kind of thing that my father would do. Certainly sitting around with a stranger, you know, and discussing his family problems was not something he felt comfortable doing, but was willing to do it in the hopes that it would get me back home.
Sounds like a divorce, doesn't it?
Very much so, yeah. Yeah.
So you got out, you know, you became a ward of the state. You ended up living in foster homes. And while you were living in a foster home, your father was murdered.
Actually, I had come out of the foster home and was living back home with him at the time of his murder. But when I moved back in with him at that time, I saw less and less of him. He had started up running two massage parlors, and he spent a lot of time there. From what I would hear him say is he had to keep an eye on the cash register. He couldn't cash, you know, trust the girls. I didn't see a lot of him the few months before his death, his abduction and then death.
Why was your father murdered? It's a long, complicated story. Maybe you can give us a kind of shorter version of it.
Sure. Essentially he was murdered because he had things that other people wanted. I mean, there's a couple different contexts to look at this. What was going on in Anchorage at the time is it was the year before they began construction on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. It was going to make a lot of people rich. It was my father had set himself up in the massage parlor trade, anticipating that this would be a very lucrative business when some 70,000 men and women were used to build the pipeline over the 3 to 4 years that it took to build it. That's sort of the backdrop to what was going on. And he was looking at setting up massage parlors in Valdez, which is the southern terminus for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. His murder really was the result of he had gotten involved in a massage parlor that had previously belonged to another man who had been tried and acquitted in the murder of the previous owner. It gets a little complicated, but my father was brought in as a prosecution witness. He was subpoenaed to testify against a man named Wesley Ladd, who had owned the parlor my father owned prior to my father's taking it over. And I think that's where it all sort of began. Ladd wanted his parlor back. And furthermore, he felt that my father was richer and connected and all these things. Actually, he believed sort of the myth of my father as an underworld figure, that he was very rich, very connected, that he owned a great deal, when in fact he didn't own a great deal.
Was he connected?
No.
He was just a small time.
Right. In a very small time underworld. He was a major figure in Anchorage's underworld, which was very small time compared to many other places.
When your father was murdered, did it make you think that the world was a lot less safe than you ever thought?
Absolutely. That's why I think I refuse to have anything to do with any of, You know, there was a lot of people I walked away. Well, my father didn't have much of an estate, if you will, to begin with, but I certainly didn't want anything. And I took a few pieces of his jewelry, costume jewelry at that, and left. I felt that that everything he owned was stained with his blood and that the life he led to his death. It was very, I couldn't have articulated it for you at the time. I was 15, but it was very frightening, I think, and very confounding. And I had enough good sense to know that I wanted nothing to do with it, while at the same time there was all kinds of people around me, people who knew him. He was married at the time to a woman that he had married not long before his death and who I write about in the book was quite young, and I did not get along with her. But, you know, there was all these people running around trying to get a piece of what Johnny Rich owned, his cars, his jewelry, his parlors, his businesses. And I simply wanted nothing to do with any of it.
When your father was murdered, you really tried to sever ties with him, cut yourself off from him and his past. You didn't even go to the funeral. Your mother had died years before that. After a series of institutionalizations, she became very sick. I believe it was cancer.
Yeah.
And she died. Did you have the same reaction to her death?
Yeah. The thing is, my mother, I had not seen her for, I last saw her when I was 9 and she died when I was 14. She actually only died a year before my father. But in many ways, as I describe it to people, I lost her when I was 6. I mean, that's when she had her full collapse and never really recovered from it. And, I mean, in some ways, really the person that I knew who had been my mother for the first 6 years of my life no longer existed after that. And I think that in many ways, when she died, it was sort of, how can I describe this? It was anticlimactic. It was as if she had died many years earlier, because I hadn't seen her in many years, and she was not the same person I had known as a small child.
Do you ever see angles where you could take advantage of somebody, having learned from what your father did? Is it ever a temptation to do that?
No. I'm just the opposite of him. I take the slow road. I'm very leery and wary of any fast buck schemes, of anyone who thinks they're going to get rich in a hurry, anyone who wants to... I mean, I went to college. I got a 4-year degree. I'm in graduate school. I worked for 5.5, 6 years as a journalist before I worked on this book. You know, I have no desire to work in business or, you know, in Alaska, real estate's a big field. You can make a lot of money in it. I'm not interested in it. I think having grown up with, in that environment has... oddly enough, has created someone myself. I'm very stable in terms of my goals and what I want to do. So I guess it would only make sense when I used to jokingly say to people, and I say this only with very sardonically, but I used to grow up with 2 fears, that I'd end up like my mother, I'd end up like my father. And, I don't have those fears anymore, but I certainly think they guided me through a lot of my early adult years in terms of making deliberate choices that I felt kept me as far away from ending up, you know, as either of them did. Either as my mother, of course I wouldn't have ended up like my mother. I don't have, she suffered from a mental illness that I don't suffer from. But in the same sense, I always knew or always felt that I had to be very strong. I always felt that strength was something that I needed to have and to always display in order to avoid becoming sick as she did. Of course, now after having done the book and the research, I realized that strength had nothing to do with it. But nonetheless, that was still a guiding principle in my life. As for my father, I sort of felt like the way he lived led him to his death, and I didn't want to live like that by any stretch of the imagination.
Kim Rich. Kim Rich is the author of Johnny's Girl, a daughter's memoir of growing up in Alaska's underworld. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. How do all the companies that send you catalogs and junk mail know about you, your income bracket, your marital status, how old your children are? Coming up, we talk with journalist Eric Larson. He says direct marketing is so sophisticated, it rivals some intelligence operations. Also, suburbia without a car. Maureen Carrigan tells us about her recent adventure out of the city. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In New York City, the UN Security Council has approved a resolution authorizing NATO planes to shoot down aircraft that violate a no-fly zone over Bosnia. The vote was 14-0 to approve the measure, with China abstaining. However, the Council, under pressure from Moscow, ruled out the use of preemptive strikes on Serbian airfields. The Security Council hopes this new resolution will apply pressure to Bosnian Serbs to sign a peace agreement already approved by Croatian and Muslim factions. UN officials have announced that several people died during a second evacuation from a besieged area of eastern Bosnia. The convoy, carrying more than 2,000 people, arrived in Tuzla, but future evacuations are now in doubt. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
There was relief in Tuzla today as the sick and wounded arrived. There was sadness and anger over the death of children crushed to death and the panic of those fighting for places aboard the 14 United Nations trucks. This is the second convoy evacuation this week. Both have been marked by frantic scenes and death. UN officials say they need more help on the ground to control the crush of desperate people. However, Bosnian officials are increasingly critical of the operation. Today, there was an official protest in Tuzla over the inhumane conditions in the trucks. Earlier in the day, local Bosnian commanders stopped the convoy on the way to Tuzla, upset over the numbers who are leaving Srebrenica. Local officials charged that the UN is participating in ethnic cleansing. Srebrenica has been besieged by Serbian forces for almost a year. Those who arrived in Tuzla today report that in Srebrenica, people are living on the streets and there is little food. In Tuzla, this is Deborah Amos.
On Capitol Hill today, members of the Senate Armed Services Committee held a second day of hearings concerning a ban against homosexuals in the military. NPR's John Greenberg reports.
The main topic was unit cohesion, a term that refers to the emotions that bind a group of soldiers together and make them follow orders. Some expert witnesses told the senators that the presence of homosexuals in the group would destroy unit cohesion. Others said there would be tensions, but strong leadership could deal with them. Lawrence Korb, an assistant secretary of defense in the Reagan administration, said if the military could integrate blacks in the 1950s, it could learn to live with gays in the 1990s. Throughout the day, some senators seemed to be looking for a middle ground between keeping the ban and doing away with it entirely. There were many questions on the possibility of allowing gays into the armed forces, but prohibiting them from revealing their sexual orientation. This is John Greenberg on Capitol Hill.
The government says that factory orders climbed to a record high last month because of consumer demands for cars and planes. The 1.4% increase in new orders followed a drop of 1.3% in January. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 22 points in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. In the Middle East, police have detained at least 500 Palestinians inside Israel on charges of violating new security restrictions. The crackdown was ordered by Israeli Prime Minister Rabin after the slayings of 13 Israelis this month. Palestinians have warned that the closure of the occupied territories, preventing more than 100,000 Palestinians from going to work in Israel, could cause more violence and encourage those opposed to Middle Eastern peace talks. Officials in Wilmington, North Carolina, have announced that actor Brandon Lee has died. The son of the late martial arts expert Bruce Lee was killed in a gun accident on the set of a movie that he was filming. Adam Hochberg of member station WUNC reports.
Witnesses told police that Lee was hit in the abdomen by a projectile while he was filming a scene for an action-adventure movie called The Crow. In the scene, Lee was shot by a gun that was supposed to be loaded with blanks. Police aren't sure whether the projectile that killed Lee came from the gun or whether it came from a grocery bag filled with small explosives that Lee was holding in his arms as part of the stunt. Wilmington Police Sergeant Ari Norval says the investigation of the death is just beginning.
The case has been classified as accidental shooting, but it is still under investigation.
There have been a number of other mishaps on the set of this movie. In February, a member of the crew was seriously injured when he touched a high-voltage wire. For National Public Radio, I'm Adam Hochberg in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Officials in Canada have placed new duties on steel products from five countries, including the United States. The Canadian government accused the five of dumping some types of steel into the country by selling at a cut-rate price. This move comes 2 days before the scheduled arrival in Canada of U.S. Trade Representative Mickey Cantor. In trading today in Europe, the U.S. dollar moved down against other major foreign currencies. Gold prices moved up. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Not long ago, I received in the mail a big envelope which said in big, bold print, "Terry Gross is one of our million-dollar winners." Of course, in smaller print, it was made clear that what they really mean is, if I enter and if I win, then I'll be a million-dollar winner. Well, why me? How did they get my name? And if I enter the sweepstakes, whose mailing list will I get on next? My guest Eric Larson has the answer to many questions about how direct mail marketing companies get information on our lives. His book is called The Naked Consumer: How Our Private Lives Become Public Commodities. Larson told me about the suspicious things he received in the mail that set off his investigation.
The first was actually when my first daughter turned one. Within 6 days of that, we got what amounted to as a corporate birthday card. And I thought this was kind of neat because I can't remember the birthdays sometimes of my own kids, I'm ashamed to say, let alone a million other kids. And here was a company that was sending us, to us parents, sending us a note acknowledging that we now had a daughter who had just turned one, how neat that was, and here are 50 offers that you might be interested in. So that was intriguing enough, but what really hooked me was when I had my second child. Within 2 weeks of that, I stepped out my door in San Francisco. We lived there at the time. And there, flapping in the breeze, literally, on my stoop, was a package of diapers, two Love's diapers, courtesy of Procter & Gamble. And what was so interesting about that is that, well, first of all, that they arrived, and second, that they had been delivered not by the regular mail, but by some other entity, presumably a newfangled kind of stork, I guess, but it was not the mailman. And then I was really hooked. And until that point, I had already started to see signs of intelligence in my mail, and I'd become really intrigued about how companies knew things like my mortgage balance, and that I had just bought a house, and that my car was about ready to trade in, you know, things like that. So I started looking, and I started trying to trace back my marketing persona through the databases of America.
So one of the things you did was kind of go undercover. What was your undercover hook?
Well, I had a couple of undercover hooks. One was I founded a direct mail company called EL Enterprises. And I did that because I wanted to hear what the marketers and brokers of names were telling each other about the rest of us. And that was really an eye-opener. I found a great reservoir of disdain for the consumer. You know, they refer to us as in many cases, as opportunity seekers, which is an industry euphemism for suckers, and they routinely trade our names and describe us as people who are you know, terrific targets and we'll go for anything and we're really voracious consumers, and all that amounts again to being opportunity seekers. You know, you can even be in a database of people who got turned down for credit. That's a very exciting database for some companies because they can pitch you scam credit offers. For example, where you sign over your house in return for a credit card, that kind of thing.
So you founded your own phony direct mail company.
Right.
And then you also...
My favorite part was when I invented a new wife. There is one very large effort afoot right now to find out the names of all the pregnant women in America. I mean, this is of intense interest to companies because pregnant women will eventually become mothers, and mothers are, at least by the marketer's viewpoint, inherently neurotic and therefore susceptible to offers of all kinds, especially first-time mothers. So anyway, I wanted to tap into this, and I invented a new mother named Angela. And to insert her into this database, I called up American Baby Magazine in New York, and I said, with, I hope, a proud tremor in my voice, I said, look, I'm about to be a father, and I'm very excited, and we want all the information we can, and I'd like to get your magazine, and how do we do that? And the operator said, well, what do you know? We have a special six-month offer where you can get 6 months free. And I thought, well, that's great. I was delighted. And she said, now, tell me your wife's name. And I did. And she said, and now tell me when your baby is due. And I gave her the due date. And then she said, and is this a first-time baby? And I said, oh, yes. And then I waited. And the due date rolled around. Of course, Angela had her baby, fortunately with no hitches. The labor was remarkably quick, instantaneous, in fact. And suddenly, within 2 weeks of that, came this torrent of mail.
Well, I learned a new word reading your book. I learned several new words, but this new word describes why it is when your daughter was born, you got little gifts from companies in the mail. The word is syncographics, and that's the word that describes how companies know how to sync up their product pitches with important moments of your life.
Right, right. That's the wave of the future. We're just seeing the beginnings of that now. And yes, I mean, this pitching all these offers to new mothers is a prime example of that. Probably my favorite example, though, was a writer friend of mine on his 40th birthday received a letter from a newsletter called Sex Over 40. It arrived on his birthday. And this is not exactly the kind of mail you want to get on your birthday. This letter essentially went on to describe all the sexual dysfunction that one can expect once you turn 40 and later on. So that's the kind of syncographics we might expect to see more of.
So how do they know when you're turning 40? This is because you bought some kind of product in which you told them in a questionnaire how old you were?
No, actually, there are many, many ways that they can find out your age. Probably the primary way is through acquisition of your motor vehicle records, which is very common. Some 35 states routinely sell your motor vehicle and your driver's license records and your registration records. And that, of course, includes birth date.
So in 35 states, if I owned a company, I could buy people's motor vehicle bureau records and use that to market my product?
Exactly, yeah. And it's done. And the states are very obliging about it, too. They will put this information on computer disks and I suppose CDs and sell it to you at cost. It's a marvelous racket.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Eric Larson. He's the author of the new book, The Naked Consumer, How Our Private Lives Become Public Commodities. And we're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Eric Larson, author of the new book, The Naked Consumer, How Our Private Lives Become Public Commodities. You know, a piece of junk mail that most of us end up getting is the Publisher's Clearinghouse sweepstakes.
Right.
And you say that this is not just, the way of getting business for Publisher's Clearinghouse, that it's an intelligence feeler. What is it designed to spot?
Well, now, we have to be a little careful about that one, because it is an intelligence feeler for Publisher's Clearinghouse. They assure me that they do not rent names to others.
I see.
But the point is that we encounter these intelligence feelers all the time. And the reason that is is an intelligence feeder for Publishers Clearinghouse, is that when you respond, you tell Publishers Clearinghouse something very important about you. You tell them that you're a responder, you know, which is, it may seem obvious, but it's very important for companies to know that. And depending on how far you go with the gimmicks and so forth, they get an even better sense of, you know, when I say the gimmicks, the various things you have to do with the envelope before you can send it back. I mean, they really put you through hoops now with all the stickers and all that stuff you gotta stick on there. They get a real indication of how enthusiastic you are about mail order stuff and about how far they can go with you. Other companies do the same kind of thing, say you'll get you may get an offer for a real sleazy product, say like a 35 millimeter camera for $10.99. And if you order that product, first of all, you may or may not get the camera. You may get a real sleazy, cheap little camera. Most important is you have betrayed yourself to be, as I referred before, an opportunity seeker, a sucker. And they love these sucker lists.
So what are you likely to get if you end up on a sucker list?
Well, once you're on a sucker list, you're going to get a lot more offers like that. You're going to get a lot of offers for free vacations, you know, where you have to go to some condo timeshare resort. And once you get there, you realize that nothing in life is free, that you are subjected to a massive sales pitch while you're there. You may get offers, the oldest scam on the books, you know, waterfront property in Oklahoma, I mean, that kind of thing. Once you're on a sucker list, you can expect an awful lot of interesting stuff to arrive at your house.
Let's get back to your real baby, not the baby of the wife that you made up just
right.
To track, just to track junk mail. When your baby was about to be 1 year old, she got a little gift in the mail. Now, how did they know that your baby was going to be one?
How'd they know?
Yeah. What had you bought that gave that information?
I think where that came from, and it's the most common source of intelligence about who's pregnant and who's not,
mm-hmm.
where we betrayed that fact, and where a lot of women do so, and men, of course, is in the birth education classes that they attend at hospitals and elsewhere now. Often the instructors... always the instructors take down the names and addresses and due dates. But what was not terribly well known is that they also pass them along to other companies like Metro Mail and so forth.
In many places now, when you're at the checkout line, you have one of those scanners. So instead of the cashier looking at the price, they just run the product over, I guess, a little laser beam or something. And
right.
it just automatically registers what the item is and what the price is. I didn't realize until I read your book that is also another intelligence network.
Yeah, that's evolving now as another hot new territory for this mass surveillance, as I like to refer to it. The important thing to remember is it's not the scanner itself that does it. I mean, the scanner is not looking up out of that little glass plate and identifying you. What happens is companies have now begun, grocery stores have now begun what are referred to as frequent shopper programs, where they lure you with special discounts and this whole sort of clubby thing to fill out a fairly detailed demographic application, in return for which you get a plastic identification card, perhaps with a barcode or a magnetic tape, very much like an ATM machine card. And so now, if you are a member, you step up to the checkout counter, and for the first time in the history of modern supermarkets, a truly unprecedented thing has occurred. They can at last link you specifically to your products, and not just that day, but throughout your purchasing history at that store. So you say, well, geez, you know, so what? I'm getting discounts, and they're getting information. The problem is products in grocery stores tell an awful lot about us now. Think about it. If you buy Preparation H, a company now can know that you have hemorrhoids and maybe run with that. You know, you can imagine the kinds of things that you might get, you know, scam cures and so forth. Let's say you buy, you're a prolific user of condoms and you buy them at the grocery store. Suddenly, a company somewhere has a real powerful sense of your sex life. And I'm not sure that people are aware that that kind of thing can happen.
A lot of what you found is pretty amusing and just, you know, interesting to know about. Of everything that you learned, what strikes you as potentially dangerous?
Well, I would say that A lot of it is potentially dangerous. In fact, all of it is potentially dangerous. But you have to be careful when I have to be careful when I say that. I mean that in America, we have in the past been at times in our nation's history very willing to sacrifice the civil rights of our peers. And often what is the most coveted commodity at those times is a list of names. For example, I cite after the invasion of Pearl Harbor, we were very quick to intern the Japanese on the West Coast. During the McCarthy era, lists, you know, people were brought before the Senate subcommittee to name names. That was the key, was naming names. And you think about some of those situations and you extrapolate if those situations occurred now. You know, the technology exists, frankly, for a Senate subcommittee to go to one of the giant databases and say, look, we know that your typical card-carrying communist or Islamic fundamentalist or pick the group you want to target has these characteristics, shops at these stores, and has done this and this and this. Please print out a list for us of everybody who fits that profile. And then they can have a huge list that while it may not be concrete and in and of itself totally accurate, could lead investigators to various people's doors without any real justification. Lists are just very, very powerful things to have, and nobody gave these companies the right to collect them, and we have no say over how they're policed, and that's always troubling.
So you see this almost as a commercial intelligence network.
Oh, very much. It is a commercial intelligence network, and it's on a far vaster scale than I think anybody really appreciates. I think it's a far more effective and vaster intelligence network than anything the CIA or FBI came up with when they were spying on domestic protest groups.
Now that you have all this information about marketing, do you wish you could use any of it to sell your book?
Well, interesting question. I had actually had this tantalizing thought, and I kind of suggested it tongue in cheek to my editor that we send to all the important book reviewers a special direct mailing telling them exactly how much they weighed and what their driver's records were and so forth. That didn't go over very well, but mostly I think because of the cost. It's a powerful kind of database out there to use. But you know, I would have been real concerned about using direct mail, frankly, to really alienate my audience.
Eric Larson, thank you very much, and happy shopping.
Oh, thank you.
Have fun with your mail.
Thank you.
Eric Larson is the author of The Naked Consumer. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. There is some criticism today for President Clinton deciding not to increase the grazing fees that ranchers pay and the royalties for mining on federal land. Environmental groups say the administration is giving in to special interests. Deborah Amos is in Bosnia. She reports on the arrival of 2,000 refugees coming from Srebrenica, being evacuated by UN convoy to Tuzla, about 60 miles away through the mountains there. Robert Siegel has the first of three reports on the threat to ethnic Hungarians living in Romania, the former Soviet Union, and in Serbia. Also, more hearings in the Senate today on the proposed lifting of the ban on gays and lesbians in the military.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. With the arrival of spring, newspaper travel sections are crammed with suggestions for spring fling weekends, trips to Washington, D.C. to watch the cherry blossoms bloom, hikes along newly defrosted mountain trails. But commentator Maureen Corrigan says if you're a city dweller and you're looking for a really exotic and cheap spring getaway, all you need to do is take a bus or train to the last stop where the pavement ends and then start walking.
A few years ago, my husband Rich was in a Florida town on business the same night that two people were murdered there, mob style. As part of the investigation, police detectives tracked down everyone who'd stayed in local motels that night. A detective eventually phoned Rich and towards the end of the interview asked him the license plate number of his car. Rich made a big mistake. he talked too much. He not only told the detective the car he drove in Florida was a rental, so he didn't know its license plate number. He told him that all the cars he drives are rentals, because he's one of those statistically scarce Americans who's never owned a car. "You've never owned a car, sir?" asked the detective. "That's right," Rich said, "and neither has my wife." The detective didn't know if he was talking to a murderer, but he knew for sure he was talking to a weirdo. Even in this age of foreign imports, there's something un-American about never having owned even a used car. And if you travel carless outside the city limits, you find out that Woody Guthrie was wrong. This land wasn't made for you and me. I learned that a few weeks ago when we bought another kind of big-ticket consumer item, a personal computer. My new PC is a lot like my old Barbie doll. It needs tons of matching accessories. And so, always on the lookout for bargains, Rich and I decided to go to one of those computer mega supermarkets. The closest one is in a Northern Virginia suburb, a landscape, obviously, where no one has tried to take a walk since Neanderthal man first invented the wheel. When we emerged from the end-of-the-line metro station, the first thing I saw was one of those signs that read, "Kiss and ride," meaning you're just supposed to drop off your commuter passengers. But some bitter suburban spouse had blackened out the E, so the sign read, "Kiss and rid." "How Cheever-esque," I commented. A minute later, I wasn't feeling so smug. I'd spoken to a store clerk over the phone who'd given me directions for reaching the computer store. "It's only 10 minutes from the station," she'd promised. Now I realized that surely the clerk had never walked from the metro station to the store. Rich and I were stranded in a suburban crazy quilt landscape where the Flintstones collided with the Jetsons. 8-lane elevated highways crisscrossed above primeval swampland. Without a space capsule or a car, I didn't see how we were going to navigate. Doing his best Daniel Day-Lewis Natty Bumpo imitation, Rich staked out a path along a drainage ditch. We began walking single file. Every so often I'd trip over a soda can or get bogged down in waist-high weeds, and Rich would call out, "I will find you!" It was funny the first time. Cars and trucks whizzed by, people yelled things, and I felt vulnerable, exposed. It took us a solid hour to reach that outpost of progress, the mall, where we wound up buying an extension cord. Everything else was too cumbersome to lug back through the wilderness. Most people who live in the suburbs think the city is a pretty frightening place. If you ask me, that's because they've never taken a walk in the wild zone beyond their windshields.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She and Rich commute to work by bus. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Joyce Lieberman, and Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, one of the world's most respected experts on chimpanzees. We talk with Jane Goodall about her 33 years in Tanzania, observing the behavior of wild chimpanzees. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.